As the Russian invasion of Ukraine intensifies, common citizens are taking up the fight.
I will try to join our army in Odessa.
Have you fought in the army ever before?
No.
Also ahead, Syrians know what it's like to be bombed by Russian planes and rockets. Russia's campaign helped keep Bashar al-Assad in power and embolden Vladimir Putin.
Putin's ego grew vastly in Syria. He felt he can do anything. He can destroy. He can kill. He can use whatever weapons with full impunity.
And in Indonesia, the government is trying to woo Elon Musk to build a spaceport on a remote island. How do the locals feel about it?
The main response was that this project was going to further threaten their forest-based livelihoods, way of life, spiritual systems.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The Russian military continues to bombard city centers across Ukraine and encircle several critical population centers. In Ukraine's second biggest city, Kharkiv, a Russian military rocket strike hit a university building. Online videos show debris crashing to the ground as the building burns. Russian attacks have reportedly targeted schools, hospitals, and critical infrastructure in key cities. Still, fierce Ukrainian resistance continues to deny Moscow an easy victory. In Kyiv, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the nation.
Сім ночей ми майже не спимо. Або спимо, але дуже тривожно.
We've hardly slept for 7 nights, Zelensky said. He went on to tell Ukrainians, quote, the time will come when we will be able to sleep, but it will be after the war, after the victory. For the latest, we're joined now by Volodymyr Solohub. He's a Ukrainian journalist and joins us now from Lviv in western Ukraine. Volodymyr, let's start with the capital city, Kyiv. What's the latest there?
Well, Carol, the situation in Kyiv is deteriorating with every passing day. The Russian forces are trying to encircle the city. Public transport is barely working. There are roadblocks inside the city. Lots of people have joined the so-called territorial defense, which is the self-made militia that are now doing the policing of the street and are trying to uncover, you know, possible saboteurs that Russia has sent to many cities across Ukraine. And still lots of people are trying to flee the city. Just literally a few hours ago, two of my friends arrived to Lviv following a very long journey on a crowded train.
And that convoy we keep hearing about, that is still stationary, kind of hanging about 20 miles outside of Kyiv?
Yes, this is something which is very worrisome and sows fear and panic among the residents of Kyiv, because if indeed their plan is to encircle the city and siege the city for weeks or months, the city, you know, the major European city, which used to be before the war, 4 million population, will be on the brink of humanitarian catastrophe.
Do we know why the convoy is still not moving? What's going on there?
Well, most likely the Russian army was faced with this surprisingly strong resistance, both by Ukrainian army and by civilians. We all know that their initial plan was a blitzkrieg by 48 hours, and reports are that they did not even have supplies for longer war. They were also expecting that Ukrainians will be welcoming them. They'll be, you know, waving Russian flags and be expecting them with open arms. And that didn't happen. So I guess this huge error in judgment and in intelligence on the side of Russian forces, where they expected that Ukrainians would be welcoming them and they're throwing Molotov cocktails at them. And the fact that there is such an incredible resistance has definitely thrown them off guard.
A lot has been going on in eastern Ukraine, in the city of Kharkiv, Ukraine's second biggest city. What has been happening there over the past day or so?
Carol, the situation in Kharkiv is even worse than in Kyiv. Yesterday in the morning, two rockets hit the largest square in Europe, the Freedom Square. Earlier today, they bombed the city hall. So the fact that second largest city is being bombarded by Russians, and again, this is the city which is very close to Russia. It's less than an hour drive from Russia. Most of the citizens there are Russian-speaking, and some 8 years back, when the Euromaidan revolution happened, Kharkiv had a strong pro-Russian element. So I guess they were expecting that Kharkiv would be the first one to fall into their hands, and this is not happening. And they decided if they're not getting it easy, they will do it the hard way.
So we've spoken about Kyiv, the capital, and also Kharkiv in the east. But there are also major developments in southern Ukraine along the Black Sea coast. What is Ukraine's defense looking like there?
Well, the southern coast, ever since Russia took over Crimea, annexed Crimea in 2014, there were talks about the so-called land bridge to Crimea, basically this land passage from Russia through Mariupol, which is a city on the southern eastern side of Ukraine, very close to Russia. So there were talks that Russia would like to create this land bridge to Crimea, because apart from air traffic, you couldn't get into Crimea. They obviously later on built that bridge. This was a very lucrative and very strategic piece of Ukrainian lands that they wanted to take ever since 2014. And I'm afraid this is exactly what we're seeing right now. And I'm afraid if Mariupol falls, Russia will get this land bridge to Crimea.
Finally, Volodymyr, you're in Lviv right now in western Ukraine. What is the situation like there? I mean, what have you seen in the days since you've arrived?
Yes, Carol, in terms of security situation, it's pretty quiet here. We're hearing these air raid alarms maybe once a day where we have to go into the bomb shelter. But apart from that, nothing more. From the standpoint of humanitarian perspective, the city has turned into this humanitarian hub, because on one hand, Lviv is receiving a lot of these refugees that are fleeing eastern Ukraine, they are fleeing Kyiv. All of them are going to Lviv. Some of them are staying here. There has been a big infrastructure set up where locals are trying to help these refugees find shelter, find food, find maybe some other assistance. And others are just using Lviv as a layover point on their journey abroad, on their journey to Poland, Slovakia, or other countries. A few days ago, I went to the border between Ukraine and Poland, and Carol, the line of cars waiting to cross the border on the Ukrainian side was almost 30 miles long. And people that were in those lines said that they had to wait for more than 48 hours in that line to cross the border. They were sleeping in their cars with their children, with their little possessions that they could take. Some of them simply were dropped off at the end of the line and were walking these 30 miles. So Lviv is pretty quiet here, but it's also very busy. On the other hand, some of the residents here in Lviv are also raising funds and trying to gather food and other clothing supplies, medical supplies, and are sending that to other cities in Ukraine to the east where this is most needed. So it's definitely a very busy place right now.
Journalist Volodymyr Solohub talking to us from Lviv in western Ukraine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In less than a week, 830,000 people have fled Ukraine. That's the latest estimate from the United Nations. Predictions are that millions more could follow. But there are also Ukrainians heading in the other direction, returning home. From the Polish border town of Przemyśle, Andrew Connolly reports.
Here at the train station, there's a constant soundtrack of trundling suitcases being dragged across the pavement. But not all are going in the direction of Poland. Last Thursday, Natalia Osinchuk was on holiday with her boyfriend Yevgeny in Sri Lanka, and then the war broke out.
Before it was good, but after we just interrupt our vacation because of this news, it was not enjoyable anymore, so we just changed our ticket and going back.
After several flights and a long car journey from Budapest, the young couple are now waiting at Przemyśle station for a train back to Lviv. That's the city in western Ukraine where the couple lives. Before the war, they both worked as software developers.
Do you know what you're going to do when you arrive?
Probably we will join some volunteers there to help somehow our army and maybe some people who just going away from the war.
So. Their suitcases are full of important supplies, like rechargeable batteries.
Like this is high-capacity power banks, and we... bigger amount of those we're gonna give away. A couple of those will give to our friends and families, because who knows what's going to be next. Maybe we'll have no electricity in the future.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has defiantly remained in Kyiv, even as it falls under daily attack. A few days ago, he banned men of military age from leaving Ukraine, and he invited any foreign fighters to come help defend the country. As a young man, Yevgeny could be drafted into the army. He doesn't relish that prospect, but he's ready to answer the call if it comes.
I met some British guy who is going to war right now on a voluntary basis, and that motivates me. If somebody from Britain is ready to go and fight against Russia, for me, for my people, like, why wouldn't I do that?
It may be several hours before people here can board the train as the authorities slowly disembark refugees coming in from Ukraine. In the cold afternoon air, men smoke fistfuls of cigarettes and drink tea handed out by volunteers. Some crack open beers. Alex Sokol was skiing in the Pyrenees when Russian forces invaded.
Have you ever served in the army before?
No, I see weapons only by TV, so I don't think that if I'll go to the army, it will be the best decision, because it's better to give weapons to the person who can do it. But I can do a lot of things which I know how to do it, and that's why I will do this, to help to my country.
Alex is 45 and works as an HR manager in a Ukrainian bank. His family is in the capital, Kyiv.
I suggest them to move to Lviv, to take a car. They said that they will stay. They believe in our army.
They're not worried about... You're not worried for them about staying there?
Yes, I'm worried very much, and they are worried about me. They asked me to stay in Poland, but I can't.
Yeah, because the pressure is too much, I think.
Yes. Yeah. In this situation, it's better to do something than just sitting and watching news.
In Kyiv, a Russian airstrike hit a TV tower that also damaged the nearby Holocaust memorial. Ukrainian officials say several people were killed.
What more do you want from Western countries to support Ukraine?
I believe they do a lot, and we really appreciate it. But actually, the main problem now is air, to close the sky. Because all damages of ordinary population is coming from sky.
Pavlo shows me a photo of his friends who've been drafted into the army. They're smiling and holding Kalashnikov rifles.
I'm going to Ukraine also.
And you're going to Ukraine to fight?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. I'm planning when I will come back, yes. I will try to join to our army in Odessa.
Have you fought in the army ever before?
No.
Pavlo works as a merchant seaman and was in the middle of a long voyage last week. But now he's on his way to his hometown, the key port city of Odessa on the Black Sea. Across Ukraine, Odessa has a reputation for its sense of humour, and it's the birthplace of many famous comedians.
What's going through your mind? Do you feel fear? Do you feel...
Of course. Only fools don't feel fair. All normal men should have fair. Yes, yes, but we will try to laugh. Odessa is a very funny city, so yes.
Many people waiting in the line here put on a brave face, but some stare in silence, some are shedding tears. A group of musicians from Germany show up and start to play. As the Ukrainians returning to defend the homeland contemplate a journey that has barely even begun. For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly in Przemyśle on the Polish-Ukrainian border.
You're listening to The World I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Countries across the globe have punished Russia with sanctions, but not Mexico. The country's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, instead is calling for dialogue. Jorge Castañeda Guzmán is a former Secretary of Foreign Affairs for Mexico and now teaches at New York University. Secretary Castañeda, why exactly is the government of Mexico declining to impose sanctions on Russia?
Well, I think there are several reasons. The first is that President López Obrador and his entourage in particular do have a certain sympathy, a certain affinity with Russia and Putin and the sort of enemy of my enemy is my friend.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Who is the enemy to
the United States? Well, the United States, obviously. It's not explicit. It's not enthusiastic, but it's there. That's why it was difficult for President López Obrador to make the decision to vote in favor of the United Nations Security Council resolution condemning the Russian invasion of Ukraine. He finally did so, but after a good couple of days or 3 or 4 days of hesitation and waltzing back and forth. So that's one reason. There's a certain affinity there. It's a sort of natural, historical chip on the shoulder, Mexican progressive anti-Americanism. It's not very new, it's not very original, but it's there. A second reason is that Mexico in general has been a big opponent of sanctions. Mexico has not been consistent with this because, for example, it did apply sanctions against South Africa, the apartheid regime in South Africa in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And then there, thirdly, there's the fact that the public opinion in Mexico is split probably over the issue. I haven't seen any polls recently since the war began, since the invasion began. But there is some sympathy in Mexico for Putin. There's some sympathy for Russia.
What's the appeal of Putin to AMLO or to certain Mexicans?
You have people, the man in the street saying, well, yeah, Putin's not nice and he's invading these other guys and that's really terrible. It's a pity. But the others will say, yeah, but he's standing up to the Americans. He's not taking any nonsense from them. And there's a certain autocratic thing. I think López Obrador has a certain amount of admiration for autocrats, not as much as Bolsonaro from Brazil, but there's a little bit of that.
Wow. That's unusual to hear.
No, you know, that's my sense of where he's at. And especially his entourage, you know, these are not issues that he's terribly interested or familiar with. He really doesn't care either way.
But does Mexico risk becoming an international pariah by taking this stance?
Well, maybe not an international pariah, but certainly not being on the American, on Biden's good side. Now, it's important to note that some of the sanctions that the U.S. and the Europeans have imposed on Russia automatically are imposed by Mexicans. For example, the expulsion from SWIFT, there are not many of them, but the few Mexican banks that remain in Mexico cannot transfer funds anymore to people in Russia, regardless of whether López Obrador wants to the overflight, closing the airspace above the United States or forbidding Russian airline overflights. The flights from St. Petersburg to Cancun, about which there were 10 a week or so, either they have to find a way to not get to Cancun overflying the United States, or they won't be able to come to Cancun anymore, regardless of whether President López Obrador imposes sanctions or not.
Don't you think this move, though, puts Mexico in a small group and not with great company? I mean, do Mexican citizens care?
Among the elites, yes, but you know, Mexican elites find it difficult to understand the notion of like-minded countries. So it's in whose company should we be? We end up in the company where this president's natural tendency and preferences take us. Believe deeply in the Cuban Revolution.
Jorge Castañeda Guzmán is a former Secretary of Foreign Affairs for Mexico. He now teaches at New York University. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Some major corporations, including Apple, Google, Ford, and Harley-Davidson, say they're stopping sales to Russia, part of a growing list of international companies turning their backs on the country. Also on the list, major European shipping companies that transport everything from cars to cabbages to and from Russian seaports. Greg Noller is Europe editor for the Journal of Commerce and joins us now from Long Beach, California. Greg Noller, who are these shipping companies and what exactly have they just done?
These shipping companies are five of the world's top seven container shipping lines. And what they've done is they've suspended all bookings for all cargo going to and from Russia. So that's effectively shutting Russia off in a maritime sense.
So are these cargo ships, the ones that are now not going to Russia, what kind of stuff did they carry? Is it mostly for industry and business, or are there a lot of consumer goods and food and things like that?
They carry everything, like you mentioned in your intro, from cabbages to automotive parts to whatever.
So bottom line, in terms of all the economic sanctions now hitting Russia, is this a big one? I mean, will this cause Russia a lot of pain and isolation?
It is a big deal, yes. There's probably about 10,000 containers, roughly speaking, that are affected right now. And the cargo that is already on the water will still be delivered, you know, at the moment. But if that is suddenly comes to an end, if they suddenly say nothing is moving to Russia from now, then all of that cargo is going to back up in the European ports, which are already quite heavily congested anyway.
So you're saying that the cargo ships, even from the companies that have said they're no longer going to serve Russia, they're on their way. And so far, those companies will still fulfill those orders until we hear otherwise?
Yeah, and until we hear otherwise, that's the way it is now. But, you know, it's a very fluid situation. The sanctions are getting worse and worse.
Greg, you're in Long Beach at a maritime conference. What are people there saying about the war and about these actions by the large shipping companies?
Well, yesterday we had the CEO of Ocean Network Express, which is one of the shipping companies that has suspended bookings to Russia. And interestingly, you know, there's a point where global trade meets doing what is morally right. And he tried to tackle that topic, saying that container shipping is an enabler of global trade, basically. And the reason that they're stopping bookings is because the sanctions just make it very difficult to move cargo into Russia. So that was his reason. So it's not a moral standpoint these carriers are taking. It seems to be a purely business decision.
Oh, that's really interesting. So that's really about logistics and the problems with doing business as opposed to taking a stand on Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Obviously, it's an emotional topic. So some people are not really happy with that. Some people believe that, you know, it should be a moral decision. But it's a bit of a murky world then, because then, you know, doing business with China gets brought into that whole discussion as well. So where do you draw the line?
Greg Noller is Europe editor for the Journal of Commerce. He was helping us understand the decision by a number of cargo shipping companies to stop business with Russia for the time being. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World.
779. That's how many people donated to The World during the fall fundraising campaign. Those 779 people helped us surpass our goal of $67,000. And we want to thank some of those incredible people right now. Jacqueline Lyon, Per Malkus, William Marston, Kevin McBride, Sophia McLean, Gina McMather, Edward Mellinger, Andrew Melton, Peter Masurlian, Tommy Nguyen. Also, thank you to not only the 779 donors, but to all of our listeners. We couldn't have done this without you.
Ukrainians fleeing war have been welcomed by neighboring European nations. For African and Middle Eastern refugees, it's been a vastly different experience. Some argue they're being held to a different standard.
I think that the way in which these other communities have been portrayed is that, well, you know, yes, it's sad that they're refugees, but really, what do you expect?
That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For many Syrians, the war in Ukraine feels painfully familiar. The Russian military is one of the most powerful armed forces on Earth. It carried out bombings in Syria to help keep Bashar al-Assad in power. The World's Shirin Jafari spoke to Syrians who say what happened in Syria emboldened President Vladimir Putin.
The past few days have brought back memories that Majd Khalaf has tried to forget.
For me and many Syrians, it's really traumatic because we know exactly what Russia will do.
Khalaf was an engineering student at the University of Aleppo when the war in Syria began in 2011. He was 19 when he joined the protests in the hopes of bringing about democratic change. The government of Bashar al-Assad used brutal tactics against protesters, and he enlisted the help of a regional ally, Iran, to crush the opposition. But to stay in power, Assad eventually needed support from the skies. That's how Russia got involved in 2015. In a speech the same year, President Putin said his country was intervening in Syria at the request of Assad himself. Putin said the goal was to go after ISIS terrorists. But in reality, Russian jets targeted opposition areas indiscriminately. Majd Khalaf, the engineering student, joined a group of volunteers called the White Helmets. They were often the first on the scene after Russian airstrikes. Khalaf says the recent videos from Ukraine remind him of his experience in Syria.
It was the same happening in Syria when Russian and Assad regime used to target the first responders, the ambulance, civilian homes, market, you know.
In 2019, a New York Times investigation revealed that the Russian Air Force repeatedly bombed hospitals in Syrian opposition areas.
Air power in Syria was decisive.
Jennifer Caffarella is with the Institute for the Study of War.
The Assad regime's air force was quite limited, and so what the Russians were able to bring was a core capacity to increase essentially the level of destruction and the level of violence from the air, which is something that neither Assad nor the Iranians could provide, and ultimately did have a devastating effect on the Syrian opposition.
Russia had other interests too, she says. It used Syria as a testing ground for weapons, some of which it's using in Ukraine today.
Different cruise missiles, right? Different weapon systems. They've even been piloting some advanced anti-drone capabilities at their airbase to try to protect that airbase from attacks. So there's a wide variety of both ways of fighting and capabilities that the Russians have tested and improved upon in Syria.
The U.S. condemned Russia's involvement in Syria, but Caffarella says Washington could have done a lot more, like imposing sanctions on Russia just as it's doing now. It also could have given the Syrian opposition more support, she says. Syrians like Salma al-Midani say the international community's response fell short, and it made them feel like the country was being abandoned.
It really makes you feel like the entire world is against you.
Al-Midani, who was born and raised in Damascus, says she empathizes with the people in Ukraine today.
We know what displacement is like. We know what it's like to have, you know, bombs rained down on you. We know what it's like to have to hide in shelters. We know what it's like to not know where to go.
Al-Midani fled the war and settled in the U.S. where she studied public health. Now she's hearing about Syrians with medical backgrounds getting ready to help those in Ukraine.
I've seen doctors who worked in field hospitals in Aleppo already ask, are there any medical missions to Ukraine right now? Like, our hospitals were bombed when they were above the ground. What happened is a lot of hospitals went underground.
Russia's involvement in Syria didn't end on the battlefield. Pro-Kremlin propaganda and misinformation flooded digital platforms. Russian trolls went after the White Helmets, the volunteer rescue group, accusing them of staging attacks and being part of terrorist groups. Mohammad Najjar fled Syria in 2012. He lived in a refugee camp in Turkey and recently resettled in the U.S.
Syria emboldened Russia. Putin's ego grew vastly in Syria. He felt he can do anything. He can destroy. He can kill. He can use whatever weapons with full impunity.
Najjar says the Russian government didn't face repercussions for its actions in Syria, and Moscow continues to support the Assad government to this day.
Syria paid heavy price. We paid in blood.
Najjar says he hopes that Russia's invasion of Ukraine will bring a more decisive response from the international community. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Nearly 900,000 people have fled Ukraine since the war there began less than a week ago. They've headed west, seeking shelter in neighboring European countries. By and large, the nations of Poland, Moldova, Hungary, Slovakia, and Romania have welcomed their neighbors. Refugees have been sheltered in repurposed schools, private apartments, and conference centers, even wineries. That's quite a contrast from refugees trying to reach Europe while fleeing war in the Middle East and Africa. To discuss this apparent double standard is H.A. Hellier. He's a fellow at Cambridge University and joins us from the UK. Professor Hellier, first, is there in fact a double standard at play here?
The double standard is in how we cover this particular set of events when it comes to Ukraine. And there's a double standard, I think, in terms of how certain politicians have described the situation. None of that should be taken to mean that we shouldn't be acting in solidarity with the people of Ukraine. But it is to point out that, you know, when we've had refugee flows over the past decade and more, that we didn't see the same sort of government policies and the same sort of media coverage as we see right now with regards to the Ukrainian situation.
Well, let's go back a bit and look at the contrast. How have non-European refugees been treated at Europe's borders in the last decade or so?
Indeed, many people die in the Mediterranean Sea just trying to flee from war because we don't want to have all of these brown people and black people coming into quote-unquote fortress Europe. So you see it, again, in terms of how different parts of the media have covered the refugee crisis over the past week, talking about these refugees are like us. These refugees are European and blonde and blue-eyed and use Instagram and Netflix. I mean, it's quite incredible. I mean, it's incredibly blatant. It's very obvious. And I think it's very telling.
Do you think it also has to do with this has happened in real time and there's been this kind of months-long buildup day by day, Russia, the U.S., Ukraine? Do you think there's also just the fact that people have been following it, whereas wars and catastrophes in Africa and Asia, perhaps for all the wrong reasons, aren't followed as closely, and so therefore people aren't responding to the drama day by day?
So I appreciate that point, and I think it would apply to a number of countries, particularly those that are now in the European Union, but were in the former Soviet Union. And Syria, it wasn't built up over a few months. It's been going on for more than a decade, and it was also basically live streamed. So I think that this is another part of the issue that, yes, we certainly seem to be getting worked up, and I think we should get worked up about Ukraine. The question that I think people have to ask themselves, and they have to do so in a sensitive fashion, right? Again, I don't want this to turn into some sort of whataboutery that is designed to get Russia off the hook or diminish the suffering of the people of Ukraine. But I think we have to ask ourselves, why did we not behave like this when even Russian forces were engaged in terrible actions in Syria? Was it simply because they weren't white and Christian?
Can you give an example or a comparative example of how the international media portrayed refugees of non-European background in recent years versus how they're portraying Ukrainians?
So, I mean, right now, just over the past week, I've seen people on BBC, people on ITV, people on Al Jazeera, I think it was NBC, where they're talking about how, you know, these are not like those people from the Middle East. They're people like us. And the, you know, it's not something that we would have expected in the same we might expect from Afghanistan or Iraq. And, you know, the implicit claim here is that, well, those people over there, they're used to this sort of thing. They're going to be refugees because their societies are just basically designed like that. So I think that the way in which these other communities have been portrayed is that, well, you know, yes, it's sad that they're refugees, but really, what do you expect?
Do you observe the media kind of catching itself on these kinds of double standards?
In the media, as well as in other industries and sectors, you will find bigots, you will find racists. But I don't think that that's really the main issue here. I think the biggest issue are people just not taking into account their own biases, their own prejudices, their own assumptions. You see this regularly, and it's not just, of course, within the media, but more generally, when it comes to political arenas and education as well, that we have these inbuilt biases that stem from our own positionality in the world, our own prejudices, our own privilege.
Terminology around this issue has been hotly debated in the past, refugee versus migrant. Can you tell us what the international definition is versus the familiar definition? And do you think this is fair?
When we describe migrants, it feeds into this notion that these refugees that are fleeing their countries, they actually have a choice. You know, we don't call the Ukrainians that are fleeing Ukraine migrants. We call them refugees. Because if we call them migrants, then it implies that they don't really need to leave. They could stay, but they've chosen to leave, in which case we can also choose not to allow them to come in. Okay. Now, obviously, they are migrants, you know, linguistically speaking, lexically speaking, yes, because they've migrated from one place to another. And this is something else that has been really abysmal in how we've covered these sorts of refugee patterns in years gone by, that we somehow make these incredible policy recommendations on the assumption that that all of these people fleeing war zones, that they have a choice. They didn't have to leave.
H.A. Hellier is a fellow at Cambridge University and a non-resident scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In recent years, some 2 million Venezuelans have resettled in neighboring Colombia. They wanted to escape economic and political turmoil back home. Many of them have obtained Colombian citizenship, and they're rebuilding their lives there. But in January, more than 40,000 people suddenly lost their legal status. That creates all kinds of problems, as Manuel Rueda reports from Bogota.
Jessica Godoy is a nurse who works part-time and is raising 2 children. I met her as she stood in line outside a government building with a folder that contained her birth certificate and other documents showing her family history here in Colombia. Godoy was trying to get her national ID card reinstated after it was canceled without warning by the National Registrar's Office. The last 2 weeks have been very hard on my family, she says. Without an ID, I can't get any work. I'm shut out of everything. Godoy was born in Venezuela and became a Colombian citizen 5 years ago. She's one of thousands of people who had their IDs canceled after the government decided to update voter rolls and take a closer look at how people born outside the country got their citizenship. According to Colombia's National Registrar, many people made mistakes or even used forged documents when they applied for citizenship. So now they must reapply or face possible deportation. Godoy was told that her ID card was canceled because she didn't present a birth certificate from Venezuela that was properly notarized. She says that 5 years ago, clerks at the registrar's office accepted her documents nevertheless and granted her a Colombian ID card. She's used it without a problem since then to travel and get health insurance. Now, those rights are suspended.
Bueno, siento mucha frustración.
It's very frustrating, she says while waiting in line. These have been very hard days. Godoy found out that her Colombian ID was canceled at the airport as she was trying to take a flight to Spain for holidays. An immigration officer looked at her passport, accused her of falsifying documents, and sent her to a police station. Godoy spent 2 nights there and then was released by immigration officers who gave her a deadline to reapply for citizenship.
No entiendo eso porque yo digo, si todo lo hice como debía ser, después de 6 años me digan que mi cédula está cancelada.
I don't understand how this could happen. I've always tried to do everything right, says Godoy. The Colombian Registrar's Office said that last year it checked the records of nearly 300,000 people who had obtained citizenship recently. It found that more than 40,000 presented incomplete documentation when they applied for citizenship. That group had their IDs canceled immediately. Almost all of them were Venezuelans, like Jessica Godoy, who obtained citizenship because at least one of their parents was born in Colombia. Human rights groups say most people were not warned that their IDs were going to be canceled. Now they are blocked from accessing their own bank accounts and even healthcare.
We have people that is not receiving the treatment for cancer. You know, mother that can't have their children at the schools. We have people that is lost in their houses because they are lost in credits.
Gabriel Arenas runs the TAP Foundation. It's a group that's helping people who've had their IDs canceled.
I think every government has the right to have a process to verify the identity of migrants and citizens. We are not fighting against that. but we are fighting against the way they did it.
Over the past 10 days, Arenas' foundation has helped 5,000 people file official complaints demanding the restoration of their citizenship. So far, Arenas says about 200 people have been able to get their IDs back, and they weren't actually required to present new documents.
That indicates that maybe someone in the process, some of the employees that the National Registry have reviewing the document made a mistake. Maybe we are seeing something related with xenophobia. I don't know.
Officials at Colombia's National Registry admit that mistakes might have been made by their own clerks. But they say the registry must still ensure that everyone who has obtained citizenship has done so with proper documents. This isn't something minor, says Rodrigo Perez, the registry's director. He said that criminals born in Venezuela have even registered as Colombian citizens to be able to travel to different countries. But rights groups say that thousands of immigrants are now paying dearly for bureaucratic mistakes. Gabriel Arenas says that this will also undermine trust in the Colombian government.
We are talking about thousands of people that a week ago, they used to love Colombia. And right now, that love is not necessarily the same because they are feeling they don't want us.
For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda in Bogota.
The World is with you every weekday on the radio. And here's another way you can connect with us, our morning newsletter. Get the three top stories of the day, a few stories that you might have missed, and a bright spot to lighten your day. It's all in our newsletter, Top of the World. Subscribe to get it in your inbox at theworld.org. The Indonesian island of Biak is isolated and small. It's home to indigenous groups and doesn't get a lot of foreign visitors. The Indonesian government, however, is trying to attract one famous outsider to this island, Elon Musk, founder of Tesla and SpaceX. But many locals aren't sure they want the attention of this billionaire. The World's Patrick Wynn reports.
That's a traditional song from Biak. Singing and communal dancing, they're a big part of life on an island where everything is pretty low-tech. Dr. Sophie Chow has spent a lot of time on this island. She's an anthropologist with the University of Sydney, and I asked her to describe a typical village on Biak.
So we're talking about a dozen or so clusters of wooden huts that are sort of aligned in a concentric circle sort of form.
They farm root vegetables like taro, and also papayas and coconuts. Chow says what's really profound about people in Biak is their deep connection to their land and all the creatures living there.
Communities understand plants and animals to be their kin, either their grandparents or their siblings, and they share common descent with these non-human beings from ancestral spirits.
Disturb their environment, and you're disrupting life itself. Sophie Chow says that is their worldview. And something like this would be very disruptive.
Lift off, Starlink 47.
That's a recent SpaceX launch out of Florida, putting a rocket the size of a skyscraper into orbit with explosive thrust equal to 4 million pounds of TNT. That could happen on Biak if Indonesian officials get their way. The government wants SpaceX to put a spaceport on the island. Why Biak? Well, it's really close to the equator, and land there spins faster than anywhere else on Earth, giving rockets a little extra oomph. Indonesian officials really want the attention of Elon Musk. The president, Joko Widodo, has personally pitched him on this spaceport.
And that contrasts radically with the lack of attention on the ground with local communities in Biak.
Sophie Chow says officials are more concerned with this one billionaire than the 120,000 people on the island. But she has asked them how they feel about this spaceport idea.
The main response was that this project was going to further threaten their forest-based livelihoods, way of life, spiritual systems.
Biak has not had great luck with outsiders. Japan invaded the island during World War II. In 1998, Indonesia's army massacred people on Biak for edging towards independence. Building this spaceport would mean evicting certain clans from land they consider sacred. And Chow says moving a few miles away might be nothing in some societies, but for folks on Biak, it's devastating.
That profoundly severs the historical, cultural, emotional, spiritual relationships of people to the lands.
Evicting one group means pushing them onto another clan's territory, which tends to start fights. A spaceport would also bring hotels and restaurants that create lots of waste. And for what? Advancing into space? Chow says for most people on Biak, that's not their dream.
The one thing that many people that I spoke to had in common was that their dream for the future wasn't just about human people, right? It was a dream that was also about the future and well-being of the forest.
Chow says, contrast that with the dreams of SpaceX, which is to eventually put people on Mars, in case we ruin Earth.
So it's, sacrificing certain local sustainability in the name of an extraplanetary sustainability.
Indonesia is courting SpaceX hard. The president has said to Elon Musk, hey, we've got lots of nickel, which is needed to make Tesla car batteries. But SpaceX hasn't said yes or no. So for now, Chow says this spaceport idea just looms over the people of Biak, leaving the island's fate up to two non-locals, a president and a billionaire. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
The 2022 Paralympic Games are set to begin in just 2 days. After a vote, the International Paralympic Committee has decided that Russian and Belarusian athletes will be allowed to compete. The IPC was under pressure from athletes and international sports bodies to ban both teams following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The World's Bianca Hillier is here with the details. Hey, Bianca.
Hey, Carol.
Bianca, so many international sports bodies have banned Russian and Belarusian athletes from future competitions. Why not the IPC? I mean, what are their reasons for allowing the teams to compete?
Yeah, the IPC said they were guided by their core principles, including a commitment to political neutrality and an unwavering belief in the transformative power of sport. Now, as a reminder, the IPC was deciding here about how the teams should be punished for their countries breaching the Olympic truce. And that's basically where countries agree to worldwide peace during the games. That agreement is supposed to start 1 week before the Olympics and last until 1 week after the Paralympics. But, Carol, this is largely a symbolic pledge, and under IPC rules, countries are not legally obligated to respect it. So if the IPC did ban the teams, it would likely be overturned in a court of law. IPC President Andrew Parsons explained at a press conference today.
No one here thinks that what is happening in Ukraine is normal or even acceptable. But again, we do have to follow the rules of our own organization under the risk of having our decisions overturned. We cannot, we don't have the authority to ban the Russian and Belarus athletes.
That sounds like a whole lot of bureaucratic nonsense to me, but okay, so no ban. But are there any repercussions here?
Kind of. So the IPC says Russian and Belarusian athletes will need to compete as neutral athletes under neutral flags. Their national anthems won't be played if they win a medal, and they have to cover up all Russian and Belarusian symbols on their uniforms.
But isn't that what the Russian team was already doing at the Olympics?
Yeah, exactly. They are already competing under the name Russian Olympic Committee because of previous state-sponsored doping violations. And they've already been competing under a neutral flag. So people who were advocating for a ban are not satisfied with today's announcement.
Especially Ukrainian athletes, right? I mean, yesterday, Bianca, you reported that hundreds of them had been asking for the Russian and Belarusian teams to be banned. How are they reacting to today's news?
They're not happy. A group of Ukrainian athletes released a statement today strongly condemning the news. They did not mince words here. They said, quote, sport administrators are choosing bloodshed and profits over principle and stakeholders. And with so many global athletes speaking out and standing in solidarity with Ukraine, we'll definitely be watching to see if any of them decide to protest at the Games, which is something Beijing and the IOC do not want to see on the field of play, at medal ceremonies, or on the podium.
The World's Bianca Hillier covers the Olympics and Paralympics. Bianca, thanks so much.
Thank you, Carol.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you back here tomorrow.